So this next section, section 6, it's called The Necessity of Being Aware During Zazen. I wonder about some of the titles on these things. But what the first, it's really about two things. One, the first part is about the middle path. And the second part is about master-disciple relationship and how to be a disciple, really. The first part the first part starts out strange, I have to say. It says, Zazen being of grave importance, neither neglect it nor regard it lightly. There have been magnificent examples of old masters in China who cut off their arms or fingers for the sake of the truth. Centuries ago, the Buddha forsook both his home and his country. To do so are sure signs of true training. Okay, the cutting off the arms and the fingers is not a good example to follow. We all know that. For master, you know, he's speaking of... especially of Taisho Eka. I know a story of Zen master cutting off a disciple's finger. I don't, you know, all the other finger cutting I think is not a good idea. That one was in a good cause, but I think it's going to an extreme that I'd rather not duplicate. And I'd go to jail for it too. It doesn't help. But of course, there was the famous story of Taisho Eka cutting off his arm to get Bodhidharma to take him as a disciple. Her master said that was an apocryphal. Is that the word I want? Apocryphal? Yeah, story. Basically, it's an illustration rather than a very likely reality. And this guy really wanted it, and probably it was the story of how much he wanted it was embellished to the point where he was cutting off his arm. And I think that's probably the case. It's very unlikely that he was actually cutting off his arm to become a disciple. If so, that's an example of disarming sincerity. But no one's completely on the money all the time, and Dogen's not completely on the money here. He goes on to say it later. He says, it is difficult to break the bones and crush the marrow from outside, and to control the mind is more difficult still. Many in olden times underwent a training which required the crushing of their bones, and if this were valuable, they would have become enlightened, but only a handful did. And they didn't, if they became enlightened, it wasn't by crushing their bones. It's probably by realizing that this is stupid, I need to stop. As you know, what happened with the Buddha, of course. He had taken ascetic practice, you know, austerity, to the point of nearly killing himself. And then realized, aha, there's a better way. And then he just took some nourishment and sat still and started the true path, entered the true path, which is the path of all acceptance. And treating both body and mind as Buddha. But this begins, this section begins this way to try to show that there have been people who have been willing to go to very great lengths to undertake training and to go through very genuine hardships. And that's certainly true. People have gone through amazing hardships to do this. And he's trying to, and he goes on to say, I know full well that they who seek things the easy way do not look for the true way. And so the first part of this is really about not trying to have everything the way you want it to be. That you have to stretch, and sometimes you have to stretch right to your limit to do this training properly. And that's definitely, absolutely true. So the first part is about not seeking the easy way of training. But seeking the way of training that's right sometimes takes you through considerable hardship. most of them internal hardships rather than external. Most of them just the hardships of dealing with self. You don't need to seek additional hardships. That's tough enough. Then the second part of this, you know, very, very long paragraph is about the fact that going to extremes of asceticism, you know, being ascetic and extremes of austerity also aren't helpful. He says that the really difficult thing, and it's repeated a number of times here, the greatest difficulty of all is the harmonizing of the training of body and mind. He says, later on, he says, neither a clear head nor a good knowledge of learning are of great importance, any more than our mind, will, consciousness, thought, understanding, or perception. All of them are useless. To enter the stream of Buddhism, one must just simply harmonize the mind and the body. Shakyamuni said that one must turn the stream of compassion within and give up both knowledge and its recognition. So he's saying, and he goes on to talk about differences of class and age, saying these don't make any difference either. But the really difficult thing, remember Master used to say, the true asceticism is to just do the 55-mile-an-hour training. Not the speeding training, which is asceticism, and not the going slow training, which is laziness and self-indulgence. But the really difficult training, the hardest thing of all, is just to do the speed limit. Just to follow the middle path truly. Why is this so? Because there's eons of karmic habit energy, you know, pulling and impelling in another direction. Deeply ingrained longing, deeply ingrained confusion that need to be gradually, patiently, sometimes firmly, most of the time firmly and gently pointed back towards the eternal. And as it gradually locks onto the eternal, then the conversion starts to happen. Remember what I said before about what the meaning of the harmonizing of mind and body is. Harmonizing with the eternal, our harmonization with the eternal, that is the real difficult thing. I've told this about myself. You know, I had a very early Kensho, and you'd think, well, if someone had such an early Kensho, that'd give them a leg up, wouldn't it? But in actual fact, it was many, many years before I even began to learn to actually really ask. Now, why is it so hard to actually just learn to ask, to turn towards the eternal and ask? I'd try little experiments with it and then back out. And I look back at what I was trying it so often just the wrong way. Now, why is it so hard to learn to depend on Buddha nature, rely on Buddha nature, when it's never remote from us? We all have a Buddha nature. It's hard because everything's externalized. It's all externalized. The whole karmically inherited point of view is all externalized. And the eternal is not anything external. Not anything to put your finger on. It's got to be reached through pure faith. And this is a lifetime of training we're talking about. Or however much of a lifetime you've got when you start trying to do this. For some people, the asking comes easier than for others. For some of them, they were never maybe wrenched as far away There was never as much of a tearing of body and mind as for others. And none of us avoid going through periods of deep confusion, which is necessary. As things start to get realigned with the eternal, there are certain stages in the harmonization where everything gets very confused. I remember going to her master back in the early 80s and saying to her, I just feel like I'm going crazy. And she said, basically, it's okay. You've just gone through a big shakeup. I've just gone through a deep retreat. And she said, you've just gone through something that was really shook things up good. And she's just trying to encourage me, it'll take time for things to settle down. Well, it took 7 years. I'm not going to read all this. You can read it yourselves. He goes on to say, one must study with a Zen master. One must never try to bring a Zen master's teaching down to one's own level of understanding. For should one try to understand it from one's own self-opinionated viewpoint, one will never understand. Now here's the dynamite thing. Here's how to ask. And it's not just how to ask a human being, it's how to ask the eternal. Before asking for the truth from a master, you must make your body and mind pure and quieten your perceptions so that both eyes and ears perceive and hear in peace. Simply listen to the teaching and do not allow it to become soiled by your own thoughts. Your body and mind must be at one with each other as water is poured from one bowl to another. If you can achieve such a state of body and mind, the truth that the master teaches can be made one with yourself. In other words, you've got to be still. The first thing you have to do to ask is so first you've got to get yourself quietened down. You've got to set the stage. So first you get yourself quietened down. And this is why the constant meditation practice is needed. First you get yourself quietened down. Then if there's a need, you're needing the sense of direction, which way do I go here? Then you can ask, what is it that's good to do? Or just what I use, I just say, please help. Then you do more waiting, listening. If you remember the way the steps came up for me, it was first you ask and then you offer. Make sure you open yourself so that you can hear the response. Let go of the clinging to what I want, what I think has to be the case. There can't be any holding on to anything in this process. It's got to be letting go. Put it all on the altar. Leave it in the hands of the eternal. Then really sit still. That's the waiting patiently. Then, as you're waiting patiently, there's a part of you that's just automatically listening. And as the harmonization happens, this process that's described in these steps, it's not like you're kind of consciously going through this process. It's most of the time. It's just that it's the habit of doing this is replacing the habit of impulsively just going with some karmic, some emotion, some opinion. You're going with a karmic impulse. It's definitely the way you want to ask your master something. But the whole point of the master-disciple relationship is to help us transfer over to the dependence and the reliance upon the eternal. That's why we have a master-disciple relationship. Remember, Master used to say, the Master represents the Eternal. It doesn't matter that the Master is just a foolish human being like yourself. That doesn't matter. It's what the Eternal makes of this relationship that matters. It's not just what, it's not what you make of it. It's not what the Master makes of it. I should say, it's not what the disciple makes of it. It's not what the Master makes of it. It's what the Eternal makes of it. You might say this is one of the most powerful tools the Eternal has to help us reharmonize with itself. Generally speaking, as a general rule of thumb, you say there needs to be many years of training with the Master and really asking and really listening in order to get to the point where the asking and the listening is, can then really transfer over completely to the Eternal. There's so many ways you can trip up in this. You have to, after you've tripped up on enough of them, you just never feel you never feel too secure in it. It's not that there isn't security in it, there is. But it's just you can't ever be complacent about it. River Master used to say, be careful when the certainty comes. Be careful when the certainty comes. Is it the certainty that really is the true conviction that comes from the Eternal? Or is it just me being fooled by the old karmic habits? Well, there's ways you learn to tell. You know, is there emotion in it? If there's emotion in it, be really careful. The still small voice doesn't impart any emotion whatsoever. If there's sentiment, if there's emotion, you need to sit still until the emotion has quieted completely and then see what's left. Is there a must in it? Is there a sense that I have to rush? Now, there are indicators. And then there's always some new thing arise, new situation arise, and it just throws you. This is, I keep saying this, that, you know, in a way you're not going to get better at coping with life by doing this. You're going to get better at recognizing how difficult it is for you to cope with life. And out of that sense of difficulty, you'll be thrown back more and more on the Eternal for your answers. And that won't make life easy. That'll just help you negotiate your way in a way that does the best for you and for others in the situations that are arising. He says, should the teaching you hear from a Zen master go against your own opinions, he is probably a good Zen master. If there is no clash of opinions in the beginning, it is bad. People who are stuck with their own opinions frequently do not know how to get rid of them and so cannot use the teaching given to them. For a long time, they suffer from grave confusion and must be regarded with great grief. Presumption, discrimination, imagination, intellect, human understanding, and the like have nothing to do with Buddhism when studying Zen. He's really saying you cannot just rely on self. You can't rely on self. You can't rely on, you know, he's saying you've got to make the leap of faith to do this. You've got to make the leap of faith. I don't care that it's scary. It doesn't matter that it's scary. It doesn't matter that so often it feels like you just got nothing to rely on if you really take that leap. You've got to be willing to try to do that. And this is why so many people can't do this training. And even of those who undertake it, so many have difficulty getting beyond what Rimesser called that stage of compassion to the deeper compassion and the deeper wisdom. Because it just feels so risky at times. He says, too many people are like children, playing with such things from their birth. You're playing with presumption, discrimination, imagination, intellect, human understanding. You're thinking that that's where the gold is. And it's just fool's gold. He says, above all, you must avoid presumption and choice. Reflect carefully upon this. Presumption and choice. Presumption, you could say, is assuming things without really listening. And it's just kind of flowing with the worldly view of things, externalized view of things. That's the presumption as I see it. Not really studying in detail. Not really getting in there and meditating with things. It's taking things at face value and trying to negotiate your way through life like that. It won't work for a trainee. It doesn't really work for anyone. The choice thing is that's impulsive choice. Impulsive choice. What's that called in independent origination? Independent origination, Rim Master was explaining this, and it's really true. That, you know, you have these like the 12 steps of dependent origination, but there's actually two steps that are really the same thing. They're really the same thing. One of them is the I don't remember the Sanskrit word, but it translates basically as choice or impulsive action. And the other one is grasping or clinging. There are two ways of doing the same thing. And those are the kind of springboards of karma and rebirth. You know, acting impulsively rather than being still and really listening, rather than really looking inwards before we leap. So he's saying here, don't just go with the old habit energy of karma, whether yours or anyone else's. Don't just go with the worldly. Don't just go with the externalized point of view and think that's good enough. It isn't. Secondly, don't be impulsive. Watch out for karmic impulse. Watch out for that process where you know, emotion builds up and then we springboard off of emotion, leap out of emotion into action. Because in a very short time, we can create a kind of karma that can take a long time to clean up. By implication, if we're not putting our energy in that direction, we're putting our energy somewhere else. Where? Meditation. Meditation and the precepts. You know, a life of faith rather than a life of basically running around in your head and falling. following your bright ideas. The people who act as my chaplain or as prior, and some of the other seniors will, could probably tell you stories about how sitting here and hear me spinning out bright ideas sometimes about something that I'm contemplating doing. But the thing is that as a bright idea spin out over usually not too long period of time, something in me is sitting back from that, waiting to see if any of those bright ideas actually gets a yes from something deeper. It's amazing how often, basically, none of them gets the yes. It's amazing. And some of them are really good ideas. Seem to me good ideas at the time. It reminds me a lot of if you smoke marijuana. I mean, I don't smoke, as a monk, I don't smoke marijuana, obviously, but as a layperson, I did a few times or a number of times when I was young. And you know how, perhaps I shouldn't assume anything here, but then I know most of the people I'm talking to. So I'll just say, you know how if you smoke marijuana, you go through a phase where you think all your ideas are brilliant, but if you actually wrote them down, people had that experience on LSD and other hallucinogenics too. People actually write their ideas down, these brilliant ideas that make so much sense. Later on, look at them when they're not under the influence of the drug. They're amazed at just, this makes no sense at all. Well, that's not just a drug experience, is what I'm saying. That's daily life. Just because something looks good, sounds good, doesn't mean it is good to do. I was saying this yesterday. You know, all that glitters is not gold. You have to learn to distinguish what is a yes from the heart and what is just the head being infatuated with some passing illusion. Then it sometimes is a case that one of those bright ideas is actually from the heart and does get the yes. When you read Rim Master's commentary on the precepts, it says, do nothing whatsoever in a hurry, do nothing whatsoever on the spur of the moment. She talks in that commentary on the precepts about the process of really sitting with the decisions we make. Is this truly good to do? Look at how she speaks of the three pure precepts. If it is good, the good that is beyond good and evil, the good that is beyond right and wrong, it is that good which does the best for everyone. And that has to come from the eternal. We want to work at being a vessel for the eternal, for the will of the eternal. Not ourselves being the bright person who comes up with the solution. Someone reminded me the other day of the story of Brer Rabbit and the Tar Baby. That story from Uncle Remus stories, just so tales or whatever they were called. You know that story where the Mr. Fox that makes it Brer Fox. Brer Fox makes a little baby out of tar and puts it in the road for Brer Rabbit to find. Brer Rabbit comes along the road and finds the tar baby and says, good morning there. And the tar baby doesn't give any response. And Brer Rabbit says, you know, that's rude of you not to, you know, say anything back. And he ends up getting in a big old fury with the tar baby and finally slugs him. Then he can't get his fist out of the tar baby. Then he hits him again. He can't get that one out. And pretty soon he's all bound up with the tar baby. Then the fox comes along and scoops him up. That's our bright ideas at work. You know, there's our bright ideas. You know, just one bright idea after another. And the more we try to fix things, the more we get wound up in the karmic tangle. This is a, you know, Any resemblance to American foreign policy is entirely accidental. I'm only speaking personally at the moment, or in terms of personal training at the moment. But it works on all levels. Often, we just need to stop trying to fix it and just be still in acceptance of what there is. Whether it be a matter of health, whether it be a matter of something seeming gone haywire with ourselves or with someone else, someone we're close to, whatever it is. There's not too many situations where you don't have the opportunity, plenty of opportunity actually, just to sit still. And, you know, unless you can find the Buddha within the particular difficulty that you're struggling with, there will be no genuine resolution in the spiritual sense. This is really important. None of us in this room is young, and we're all really likely at any time, you know, to get seriously ill. This is one example. If that happens, is that illness a Buddha? Or is it just something to be got rid of as fast as possible? Is it something that we take as a teacher? Is it something that we bow to? Or is it something just to be got rid of? Same is true in human relationships. If there's a difficulty in human relationship, is this difficulty a Buddha that we can learn from, that we can accept? Or is it just something to be got rid of as fast as possible? The more you try to just get, the more your focus just becomes a negative focus of trying to get rid, the more it comes right around and gets you behind the head. The more wrapped up you get in the tar baby. The thing that cuts through it is sitting still. You know, remember Matthew said that bumper sticker on her car that said, don't just do something, sit there. You've got to cut through it with meditation. I've told this story before. In the first couple of days when I went to the retreat in 1998, I was shown just glimpses of very clear, totally unemotional glimpses of two past lives. One of them was of a man who was being killed by, I think it was about three other people in a yurt type thing. It's probably kind of Mongol or Tartar kind of situation. The other one was an American Indian. And they came up in that order, too, if I remember correctly. The teaching was given with each one. They were each one just given as an illustration from my karmic past of a particular teaching. And these, I was being given the ground rules that I needed for the next year's training, and really for the rest of my life. The first ground rule was, basically, that everything is Buddha, and every aspect of every situation is Buddha. So I would just walk through it, and this was in pure intuition, but I would just walk through it. So it was made really clear that the kind of knives or short swords with which the person was killed were Buddha. The people who were doing the killing was Buddha. The pain of the killing was Buddha. The death itself was Buddha. Every aspect was Buddha. No conditions on it. This is all Buddha. What does that mean? It means there's nothing fundamentally wrong here. Remember in the scripture in the Immeasurable Life of the Tathagata, it speaks about those besmirched creatures who go into grief and horror, distress and fear on seeing the kind of disillusion of the cosmos, or any aspect of it, in the face of the kind of horror of existence. You don't have to go that route. You have a choice not to go that route. You have a choice to to sit still and to look up. You have that choice. Don't turn a Buddha into a demon. Instead, you've got to learn to see the demon as the Buddha. The real you cannot be hurt. It's not subject to birth and death. What you truly are is not subject to birth and death. This body and mind is completely subject to birth and death. And very easy to destroy. That is not your true refuge. The other teaching I was given in the other case was just very simply that no matter what horrific things people do, the intention is always comes from a fundamentally pure place. It's just under the influence of confusion and pain, things get warped until they're doing horrific things. But the fundamental motivation is always pure. And that was just shown and illustrated by a man who decided the best way to stop the white settlers from invading and taking over the Indian lands was just to kill all the women, because it's women who had the white babies. So he went on a rampage murdering women. So do not allow yourself, in the face of the you know, admittedly, you know, sometimes great difficulties that we encounter in life, do not allow yourself to look down and to succumb to despair and horror and black grief. It doesn't have to be that way. When you find that you're getting sucked into that, pull back out of it and really sit still and meditate and turn it over into the hands of the Eternal. The big danger for all of us is that we try to play God. And then we're inevitably faced with the fact that we can't do a thing about something. You can't really change something. You can't remove the basic pain of a particular situation. And because we're playing God, then we despair. If we weren't playing God, we wouldn't despair. So the whole point of meditation is you sit there and you open your heart to the Eternal and you place everything into the hands of the Eternal. All your worries, all your fears, all your pain, worries about yourself and others, fear and dread about yourself and others. You know, not my will, but thine. Then from that place, then what is it that's good to do? Then you can act in a grounded, non-emotional way. I should say non-emotionalistic way. It doesn't mean there won't be feelings. Of course, there's sometimes going to be very intense feelings. It's just being human. But emotionalism is where you get into a cycle of negativity, basically, or any cycle of feeling where basically you act in such a way as to feed the particular emotion. You act out of the emotion and you act in such a way to feed back into it, so you get a kind of cycle revving. And that's not helpful. It just, you lose your spiritual grounding. You don't have good judgment when you do that. And you won't do what's really best for yourself and for others if you're wrapped up in emotion like that. And since we all have some amazingly powerful emotions at times, there just is no substitute for the practice of meditation. I mean, practice of formal meditation, I mean working at our meditation throughout the day. Prince.